Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and with me at the other end of the phone line is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good morning, everyone. We're in the middle of a heat wave.
Yeah, and a heat and humidity wave.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's Iowa. You know
yeah,
that.
Yeah. I'm thinking of riding my bike into the office in a little bit. I'm just not sure if it's too hot to do that. But it is an electric bike, so it's not like I have to really strain. So
just be careful.
Yeah. So this morning we have a really interesting, fun, and informative book to talk about. Our guest is Eric Weiner. He's an award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and speaker. His books include The Geography of Bliss, The Geography of Genius, Man Seeks God, and The Socrates Express. They've been translated into more than 20 languages. Eric is a former foreign correspondent for NPR and reporter for The New York Times. He's a regular contributor to The Washington Post, BBC Travel, and Afar, among other publications. He lives in the Washington, D.C. area, and the book that we're talking about today, which just came out, is Ben and Me, In Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Eric.
Good to be with you. I like your three-word description of the book. Interesting, fun, and informative, I think it was. Something like that. Seems on target.
Yeah, and your book is a little hard to put in a, like, where in the genre section would it go? It's a little tough to, because it's crossing boundaries, isn't it?
Right, which is a mixed blessing of discovering. I think it's an act of creativity to write essentially a hybrid book that's part memoir, part travelogue, part history, part biography, part personal prescription, a lot of parts. but then booksellers and people like you don't always know what to do with the book, because people like things to go in boxes. We live in that kind of world. But no, this book is not easily put in a box, which I think overall is a good thing.
Well, it seems to me that Ben Franklin couldn't really be put in a box either, could he?
That's a good point. I like that connection. I like the way you're thinking. He could not. What was he? Was he a printer? Well, that was his first job. Was he a statesman? Yes. Was he a meteorologist, a scientist, a postmaster, an essayist, an editor, a publisher, a humorist? Was he a conservative or a liberal? We can talk about that later. I think he doesn't, despite the fact that his face is on the $100 bill, I argue he had even socialist leanings as well. So, no, cannot put the man in a box, not at all.
Was he religious? Was he non-religious?
That's another good one. Not conventionally religious.
Right.
Definitely not conventionally religious. But... would pray to, I love this, powerful goodness, he called it. And I really like that phrase, you know, powerful goodness. And that really described his religion. His religion was doing good and being useful. And that's why the subtitle of the book is In Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. That was Ben's religion.
Mm. So, Caroline, you are... I think older than Ben was when he passed away. How old was Ben Franklin when he died?
He was 84 years and 3 months.
84 years and 3 months. And what do you remember learning about him when you were young?
Me?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh. I don't remember learning. Well, to tell you the truth, Monica, at my age, which is 89, I can't remember a lot that I learned when I was in school. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I'll be perfectly honest with you.
We're younger than you, but we don't remember much either. So don't feel bad.
Well, what surprised you in reading this book then? Was there anything that jumped out at you that you want to ask Eric about?
Well, I something that did was interesting, I thought, was that he never had received a high school diploma, but he had honorary titles from St. Andrews University in Scotland and from Oxford University. And I found that very interesting. I mean, he didn't let it keep him. He just he wanted to know things, and so he found them out, and he just, you know, I was really amazed with the thing. He was a very amazing person. He really was.
Yeah, he only had 2 years of formal education. By age 10, his father yanked him out of school in Boston, and that was it. But you're absolutely right. He went on to receive 2 honorary doctorates, and toward, you know, later in life, and even to this day, he's known as Dr. Franklin. And he was not a doctor. He did not have a doctorate. It was an honorary degree. He was not a medical doctor, though he had a great interest in medicine. And he was self-taught, and he taught himself through the book. The book was his lifeline, and they were precious commodities in Boston in the early 18th century, and he would get his hands on them any way he could. He briefly became a vegetarian in Boston so he could save money on food and have more money to buy books. Now, that's a dedicated reader, you have to say.
Now, he didn't remain a vegetarian then?
No. It was fairly short-lived. And he tells this great story. He's, in fact, running away from home. So he's on a ship out of Boston heading for New York and ultimately Philadelphia. And it, you know, the winds are not cooperating, and they run out of food on board, so they have to start fishing overboard, and they bring out this cod, and the cook is sizzling this cod, and it smells delicious, and Franklin's like, oh, but I'm a vegetarian. And then he notices small fish inside the bigger fish, and he reasons, well, if the fish can eat each other, then surely I can eat them. And then he says, isn't it a wonderful thing to be a rational person? You can reason yourself to anything. And so that was essentially the end of his vegetarianism. For the most part, he had spates of it when he was trying to save money or make a point. But that point about reason, I think, is interesting, because he was a very rational person. You know, the age of enlightenment in which he lived was also known as the age of reason. But he also had a side to him that was irrational, I would say, or that valued the irrational. He recognized the limits of reason and how we could use reason just to trick ourselves. And we had to be aware of that. So another box you can't put him into.
When he was running away from Boston, he was actually running away from, and this is something I did not know until I read your book, he was skipping out on his contract of apprenticeship, which was a legally binding contract, mm-hmm. which basically kind of made him an indentured servant to his brother.
In a way, to his brother, and it made him an outlaw, basically a felon on the run, essentially, when he left Boston. And there were all kinds of complicating factors of sort of backroom deals he had made with his brother, which made it unlikely that his brother would go after him or have the law go after him. But technically, you know, he could have been arrested in New York or Philadelphia, but nobody asked too many questions, certainly in Philadelphia at the time. So he never faced any serious threat of arrest, I think.
I find that really interesting, though, because as you point out in one of the ways in which Ben disappoints you, when he had his newspaper in Philadelphia, he would print ads for the capture of runaway slaves mm-hmm. and for runaway apprentices.
Yes.
And he profited from the same thing that he himself got away with.
Yes, he did. And we can talk about his changing views on slavery, but certainly for a while, he profited directly by running ads. Later in life, he freed any slaves that he had, and he became a quite vocal abolitionist, which to me is one of the most admirable things about him, is his ability to change his mind about important issues like democracy and slavery, and even well later into life. You know, most of us become more set in our ways as we grow older. I'm sure that's not the case for your mom, Caroline, but most of us become more set in our ways. And Franklin did not. He remained intellectually and morally flexible in a good way, I think.
One of the things that we've kind of always heard about him was that he was a womanizer, and particularly in France. And You address that in the book.
It's amazing how many people, it seems most people know two things about Franklin, the electrified kite and the womanizing, you know, and only those two. And both are kind of true and kind of not. So do you want me to weigh in on that?
Yes,
issue?
Yes.
Yeah, so he definitely was a huge flirt throughout his life. There's no doubt about that. And some think that was one manifestation of his greatness was as a diplomat. You have to kind of be a seducer and a flirt. And he was a diplomat in France and in London as well. So he had that skill set. Now, he was married for many years. Was he ever unfaithful to his wife during their long separations? There is no evidence of that. But as we know, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And there were no paparazzi back then. And so we don't really know for sure. In France, he was 70 years old when he washed up on the shores of Brittany in France and spent 8 years there. And by then, he had quite a few health problems, gout, kidney stone, psoriasis most likely. There were days he couldn't get out of his own bed, let alone hop into someone else's. But he was flirting with the likes of Madame Brion and others. And we have the paper trail, you know, where you can read their flirtations. But was there evidence that it went beyond that? Again, no evidence, but, you know, we will never know for sure.
Good thing they didn't have text messages back then, or we might know more than we'd want to know.
That's true. I mean, they had letter writing, though, and the letters were more thoughtful. You know, they were not coming to your place at 11 p.m. or you're awake, you know. They were not like that. But, you know, he left a paper trail of 43 volumes. I think it's up to 44 now in the Franklin Papers. Mostly, almost exclusively correspondence, you know, and you can get to know someone from the 18th century in a way better than you could someone from today, because our emails and our text messages they're not as thoughtful as the Republic of Letters as it was known in the 18th century.
Right. Plus now, if you want to communicate with someone, you can pick up the phone or you can call them on a video call and have, there's no record of what's said.
Right. And that's the ironic thing is that this is another issue for maybe another show, but I would argue that, so I'm looking 250, 300 years back. I would say someone, a future historian looking back at this time, would actually have a harder time piecing together what was going on, because of changing technology. And, you know, I don't think 300 years from now, the conversation we're having right now will be enshrined in some museum or any historian will have access to it. So, yeah, in a way, and I learned an interesting fact researching the book was that paper, the books that were published in the 18th century were sturdier than those published today. They lasted longer. It was a higher quality paper. So those books are still around from Franklin's time, but the books we write today, physical copies, may not be around 300 years from now.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
I know.
We should do something about that.
We should. And there are some historians who are trying to like preserve the record. And, you know, if you think about it, Caroline's probably old enough to remember the floppy disk. I don't know about you, Monica. But,
oh,
you
for
know.
Heaven's sakes.
Okay, you are. All right.
I'm old enough to – the first computer I ever worked with, you recorded things on a cassette. So,
okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
I am almost exactly your age, by the way.
Okay. All right. My mistake. So the point is, try reading a floppy disk today. You've got to get the equipment.
Another story.
Even
CDs. I was looking up some documents that were on a CD, and I had to go. I only have one computer that still has a CD drive on it.
Right. So we're fortunate that we have the historical record of someone like Franklin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And letter writing was such an art.
It was. It was like reading literature. I mean, not always. Sometimes, you know, I actually touched some of Franklin's letters in London. They didn't even require I wear gloves, which was odd. But this was at the Royal Society for the Arts in London, and he was a member there, and they have some of his physical correspondence. And the ones I saw there were very quotidian, like, you know, sending you a receipt, you know, here's an invoice for this. So, not all of it was literature, but you can find literature in there. And if you read, I think the some publisher, I forget, American Library Group or some publishers put together basically the best of Franklin's writing and correspondence in two volumes. And there you can certainly find literature in his letter writing.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Eric Weiner, author of Ben and Me, In Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. What drew you to write about Ben Franklin?
It was a case of serendipity, of happy accidents. Maybe all books, I don't know. I talk to a lot of writers. I imagine that might be a common theme. It's not the kind of subject I would normally write about. As you mentioned earlier, I was a former foreign correspondent for NPR. I'm a big traveler, travel writing and sort of philosophy. The intersection of place and ideas is essentially what I do. And I've been drawn to foreigners, to, Mahatma Gandhi, Confucius, Socrates, these foreigners I've written about. Never really written in depth about an American. And this kind of started to bug me, and this was a few years ago, sort of mid-pandemic, late pandemic. I couldn't travel that much, and I was talking to my editor at Avid Reader Press, imprint of Simon & Schuster, about what do I do next. And he said, maybe you should write a book on UFOs. I really didn't want to write a book about UFOs, but when your editor says, maybe you should write a book on this, the only appropriate answer is, well, sure, I'll look into it. So I did look into it and really didn't want to write a book on UFOs, but I came across this article in Salon Magazine that was titled, Our Founding Fathers, Alien Obsessed. And I thought, really? And it turns out that many of the founders did firmly believe in the possibility of intelligent life in the universe, in a plurality of worlds, they called it. And one of those people was, yes, Benjamin Franklin. And then I started reading about Franklin, and reading about his 13 virtues that he came up with while in his 20s, and his plan for moral perfection, and this whole other side to him that I didn't know about. And I got back to my editor and said, well, still don't want to write the book on UFOs, but I do want to write a book on Ben Franklin. He said, go for it. So it was new territory for me. It was sort of my coming home in a way.
Well, one thing I found interesting that he was not a good public speaker, you said, but he thought people talk too much, robbing others of the chance of engaging. Mm-hmm. And that was talking over much. That was one of his
talking
things.
Over much, definitely a problem today. He valued, one of his 13 virtues was silence. And so he valued that. He was good in like a small group of people he knew, either one-on-one with a friend or a group of friends. Much more reticent with strangers and not a good public speaker. So probably would not be a great like TV personality if he were to come back today. But he was a wonderful writer, as we know. And one-on-one or in small groups of friends, he could tell stories. And James Madison, for instance, who was way younger than him, marveled at how there was never a dull moment when you were having a conversation with Benjamin Franklin.
Another thing that surprised me about him was, and I should have realized this, but how he really, his writing career took off because he pretended, he wrote anonymously as people very much unlike who he actually was.
In fact, that's where I was going to read from.
Okay. Why don't you do that? Yes.
Should I explain that and do that?
Sure.
Because it will answer your question.
Of course.
Okay. So I'm going to set up the passage, which is exactly what the question you asked about. So he's 16 years old. He's living in Boston, and he wants to be a writer. But he's got 2 years of education. He's working as an apprentice in his brother's print shop, and his brother also runs a local newspaper called the New England Courant. Ben knows there's no way his brother, James, older brother, is going to let him write for the paper. So he comes up with this pseudonym, this character named Silence Do-Good. And Silence Do-Good is a middle-aged widow from Boston. Now, imagine this. He's a 16-year-old teenage boy, but he's able to create this character so convincingly, and he disguises his handwriting, slips these essays under the door of the newspaper. His brother James loves these essays and prints them, more than a dozen, on the front page of the New England Courant. And it was so convincing that some male readers wrote into Silence Duguid, who didn't exist, proposing marriage. So that, and that, this will give you, this passage will give you an idea about Franklin's use of pseudonyms and what I call masking. So here we go. Silence Duguid was Franklin's first mask, but by no means his last. Masking became a lifelong habit. Let all men know thee, but no man know thee thoroughly, said Richard Saunders. Only it wasn't really Richard Saunders. He didn't exist. Nor did Alice Addertong or Polly Baker or Celia Shortface or Jethro Standfast or Anthony Afterwardwit or Ephraim Censorious or Martha Careful or dozens of other invented characters. Franklin's mask came in many forms. They might be rich or poor, common or aristocratic, male or female, young or old. He wrote as a Native American chief, an enslaved African, an Algerian emir. He wrote as a pregnant single woman and as the king of Prussia. He wrote from the perspective of the letter Z, a deformed leg, a mayfly, and his own gout. All this masking, I confess, makes me uneasy. Who was the man behind the mask, or was Ben Franklin all mask? Biographers have combed through every follicle of the historical record looking for the real Benjamin Franklin. They have yet to find him. He is the stealth founder. Maybe Franklin was just a more extreme example of a charade we all engage in. We all wear masks. Perhaps I am just as veiled as Franklin. At home, I wear the husband mask and the dad mask. Out in the world, I wore my journalism mask for many years. It was a good mask, a useful one, up to a point. It was excellent at concealing, enabling me to feign impartiality and report effectively, but not so good at revealing. I exchanged it for my writer mask, which is more useful, albeit extremely fragile. Then there is my extrovert mask, nearly as brittle and in need of constant recharging. I suspect I wear other masks as well, covert ones I'm not even aware I'm wearing. Maybe it is not me speaking these words, but a masked version of me. Does this make me a phony, as some labeled Franklin? Or is it the anti-maskers who are duplicitous while Franklin practiced a kind of masked authenticity? There is the word that lies at the heart of all these vexing questions, authenticity. We're told it is the highest ideal, that our essential task is to live an authentic life, to find our real self, as if it's gone missing, like our car keys or a wayward sock. To call someone inauthentic is to accuse them of acting in bad faith, as the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said, and suggest they are somehow immoral. Our cult of authenticity, as one scholar calls our obsession with finding our true self, can be traced to Polonius, the character in Shakespeare's Hamlet, who dispensed fatherly advice to his son. To thy own self be true, he said. So seemingly self-evident is the primacy of authenticity that we rarely question it. But what if it's not true? What if there is no authentic self to find, only a collection of masks in various shapes and sizes? What if the Buddhists are right and there is no authentic self because there is no self? The notion that we possess a fixed identity is an illusion. All is flux, including us. This aspect of Buddhist philosophy unnerves me. I may be a neurotic person prone to bouts of melancholy, but I always thought of myself at least as a person, a solid self. Now I'm told this is an illusion. I don't like this, I think, but who is the I that is doing the thinking? If there is none, then how am I supposed to get out of bed in the morning? What prevents my non-self from floating off into the ether? And crucially, if there is no self, then who has been shelling out all that money to my therapist? The philosopher and 1960s guru Alan Watts offered a way out of this metaphysical maze. Stop fretting about this illusory authentic self and instead be a genuine fake. Genuine fakes are not con artists and they are not deluded. Genuine fakes so fully inhabit their role, their roles, there is no distinction, no distance between part and person, mask and face. What matters is not the kind of mask we wear, but how well they fit. Ben Franklin's mask fit well. He was a genuine fake. Franklin subscribed to an as-if philosophy. Live your life as if it were good, and before you know it, it is good. Treat your fellow humans as if they were good, and in due course, they are good, or at least better. As Franklin said, speaking through one of his masks, Richard Saunders, what you would seem to be really. Hmm. And that is Franklin and Masking.
And that is Eric Weiner reading from Ben and Me in Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. Of course, his character, his writing mask that is most remembered now, I think, is Poor Richard.
Right. That's Richard Saunders. Saunders was Poor Richard, and that was Poor Richard's almanac.
Right. Yeah. And how is Poor Richard different than Ben?
Well, Poor Richard claimed to be an astrologer because a lot of these almanacs back then, they were quite popular, and they were sort of a compendium of weather forecasts, farming information, holiday season schedules, and astrological predictions. So Poor Richard Saunders, claimed to be an impoverished astrologer eking out a living and married to Bridget Saunders, who was this overbearing wife who had very caviar taste despite his poverty. And he had an imperious publisher named Benjamin Franklin, who ran off with all the profits. so it was a wonderfully playful scenario that he invented in Poor Richard, and it was wildly popular. I mean, like, if you walked into a house in Pennsylvania, in the 1730s or 40s, and you'd find two books, the Bible and Poor Richard's Almanac. It helped make Benjamin Franklin a wealthy man.
Wow. Well, I think the Farmer's Almanac today still is popular in rural areas.
Right back to Poor Richard and to the other almanacs then, absolutely.
Yeah, because I can remember maybe 30, 40 years ago hearing people talk about they were going to plant their crops or plant their gardens based on what the Farmer's Almanac said.
Yeah, right.
And that's what Poor Richard's Almanac was about. I mean, it was also useful, but it's these sort of pithy sayings, such as early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise, that we recall. And so each edition that came out once a year was filled with these, some original, most sort of not, most I would say adapted or adopted by Franklin and he massaged them and tightened them and made them pop more, I would say. And he was very good at that. He was a good marketer in a way.
And he wasn't always early to bed and early to rise himself, was he?
Well, he liked to create the impression of that. He thought it was important not only to work hard, and he did work hard, especially in Philadelphia. He's making his way up the chain as a printer. And he said, he wrote this in his autobiography, he said, make sure you have a wheelbarrow that makes lots of noise going down the street at 5 a.m. so people can see that you're on your way to work, and that not just that you're working hard, but people know you're working hard. So if he were a life coach today, which I think he'd be a pretty good life coach, he would suggest, like at the office, make sure people know what you're doing and they know that, you get credit for this work you're doing. It's not, again, not that he was a scamster. I don't think he was. He wasn't scamming anyone. He did work hard in Philadelphia. Now, France, he went in Rome, do as the Romans, and went in France, do as the French, and they were not early risers, so Franklin wasn't either. He would stay up late with them playing chess, drinking Madeira wine, and in his own way, negotiating alliances.
Mm. Wow.
So he was an actor in a way. And he would, in London, he would play the role of the proper gentleman, lived there for 15 years, wearing a nice suit and everything. But in France, he played the role that they wanted of him, which was the sort of wise backwoodsman philosopher with a fur cap, in simple clothing, but said the most profound things. And oh, my God, the French just ate it up.
Now, you said he lived 15 years in London, he lived 7 years in France, and his wife was not with him, and there were no cross-the-ocean journeys to visit one another. during those
No.
times.
So let's take a look at the London years. This is when he's 1757. He's a successful businessman, and the Pennsylvania Assembly says, "Ben, we need you to go over and negotiate with these odious Penn brothers, from the Penn family, as in Pennsylvania, who were taking advantage of the people of Pennsylvania from doing it from London." So Ben goes over there for what he thinks is 6 months, ends up being 15 plus years. And his wife, Deborah, had this fear of sailing, which was not an unfounded fear back then, because it was pretty dangerous sailing the Atlantic. You weren't sure you were going to arrive. But she had a fear of the water the way people have fear of flying today, I think. She would not even really cross the Delaware River in a boat. That's the story. Now, if you read their correspondence, now there were no visits. Franklin did come home for a visit mid-London for about a year and then went back. But they did not have the warmest, most affectionate of marriages. It seemed a little more transactional, almost like business partners. And I don't know the extent that was just the nature of marriage back then or the nature of their particular marriage. And so I wonder, and as do many historians, whether she was really that afraid of sailing, or it was just convenient for both of them, or certainly for Ben. I think he enjoyed his time in London alone. He did write to her often, and they sent packages back and forth. He would send her, you know, goodies he brought in markets in London, and she would send some of his favorite things from the colonies, pippin apples, for instance, and venison, and all kinds of little goodies. So, I mean, there was affection that way. It was just, it didn't seem highly romantic. And by the time he got to France, she had passed away. She died well before him of a stroke. And so he could not be unfaithful in France.
Now, you don't actually, she doesn't feature in your book very much.
Well, we don't know a lot about her. She did write letters. She was mostly literate, but hard to follow. That not her fault. Women were not as educated as men, so the letters are, the spelling is all off, and it's a bit hard to follow. And there is, I believe, one portrait of Deborah, and there are hundreds, probably, of Benjamin Franklin. So we don't know a lot about her. You know, we could talk, his sister Jane Franklin, became Jane Meakin. The correspondence is even greater there. He wrote to Jane more than anyone else, and we know a bit more about her. Joan Lepore, the historian, wrote a good book about Jane Franklin. But I sense more genuine affection between Ben and his sister Jane than with his wife, actually.
And how many children did they have?
It's a bit tricky. It's complicated. Can't put him in a box that way. So they had William, Franklin's son, was born out of wedlock. We do not know to this day who the mother was. Could have been a waitress at an oyster bar, is some speculation. We don't know. But Deborah Franklin essentially adopted William and raised him as her son from a young age. And Deborah and Benjamin Franklin did have a son of their own named Frank or Frankie. And this is one of the tragedies of Franklin's life, is Frankie died at age 4 from smallpox. And Benjamin Franklin was an advocate of smallpox inoculation, which did exist back then, a sort of primitive kind of vaccine, but it was effective. And he was going to get Frankie inoculated, but Frankie had some stomach upset. And by the time they got around to it, it was too late. He had contracted smallpox. And Franklin had great, as I say in the book, emotional buoyancy, but that was one thing that rocked his ship, because even 30 years later, 40 years later, he said he could not mention or think of Frankie without a deep, sad sigh.
Wow. Did they have any other children?
No.
No.
No other children? Oh, no. Oh, my gosh. I forgot Sally.
There was a daughter in there.
I know. No other sons, but they had Sarah, who's known as Sally. And I stand corrected. I'm sorry. I haven't had enough coffee this morning. They had Sally, who Franklin was close to. They had a good relationship. You know, he didn't give her the education he had given William, his son. but taught her to play musical instruments, and they would play together sometimes. But don't forget, he was away. He was an absentee father and dad for long stretches of time. I mean, we think of him as this very American of the American founders, and this is the thing about him. He was, on one hand, he was the earthiest, most sort of American of the founders. Working class, only 2 years education, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, the American dream and all that. On the other hand, he was the most cosmopolitan international. He could read seven languages, speak French pretty well, lived in England 2 years as a young man and 15 years as an older man, France for actually 8 years, and traveled to Canada and Scotland and Ireland and the Netherlands. So he was the most grounded and the most worldly at the same time, an interesting combination.
And he was close to his grandsons.
Yes, William and Benny. And William was the no, not William. William Temple, who was became known as Temple. I stand corrected. He was William Temple. In order to really confuse you with his father, he went by Temple. And if you've seen the Apple Plus TV series with Michael Douglas, it focuses on his years in France, and Temple plays a large role. To be honest, a larger role than he played in real life, I think, in France. But he did travel with. Benjamin Temple did to France, and he was his right-hand man, is what Benjamin Franklin said, and they were close. Although Temple ended up being kind of a disappointment later in life, he did not really amount to much, and he was put in charge of Franklin's autobiography, and he squandered that, he misplaced papers, and this is why, fun fact, Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, one of the best-known pieces of literature in the American canon, was first published in French in France, or it was translated back to English and back here. It's a strange twist.
Wow. And then was Benny also?
Benny was younger and ended up having a remarkable but too short-lived life. He came back to Philadelphia. Now he speaks French and English and he followed in his grandfather's footsteps, and like Temple, became a printer, and then a newspaper publisher, published the Aurora, the American Aurora paper in Philadelphia, but died way too young, I think like at 30 or something ridiculously young of a disease, yellow fever, I believe. And he was closer in personality and disposition to Benjamin Franklin than Temple was, I think.
Was William his father, or was Sally?
William was his father. There
William
was
was
this
his
long
father.
tradition in the Franklin family of illegitimate children. So,
Oh.
Benjamin Franklin had an illegitimate child, William. Then William had an illegitimate child, Temple. And then Temple had an illegitimate child who we don't know. And I'm sorry again. Benny was Sarah's son, so I stand corrected there.
Okay.
We need to
Wow.
draw a family tree here, I think.
Very complicated
It's a
family.
complicated family, as most families are, but Franklin was the patriarch.
That's for sure. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Eric Weiner, author of Ben and Me, In Search of a Founder's Formula for Long and Useful Life.
One thing that I'm sure I never learned, if I did study about him, was that he was very influential in getting money from France so that we could run the revolution, because they were out of everything. They didn't have any guns, they didn't have any uniforms, they didn't have anything, here. And France sent money and everything. I mean, that was amazing that he was able to do that, I think.
Yeah, I think, as they say in the book, that Franklin was, after George Washington, Franklin was the most important player and actor in the Revolutionary War, and that we would not have won the war without him and his diplomatic efforts in France. He convinced them, charmed them, really, into coughing up what would be billions of dollars today in aid and supplies, and then direct military intervention. The French ended up fighting on sea and land alongside us, and that was Franklin's doing, in France. And Yeah, he was absolutely key. Was not much of a soldier. He was briefly in a militia in Pennsylvania, but he was a tremendous diplomat.
Well, so Eric, let's talk a little bit about the how you structured this book. You have, I think it's 26 chapters, and each of them are looking at Ben from a kind of a different angle. So you have bookish Ben, you have resilient Ben, you have habitual Ben, social Ben, Buddha Ben, which is one I want to ask you about,
And don't forget Naked Ben, too.
naked Ben. So first of all, I'm wondering, at what point in your when you started researching this book, at what point did you settle on this as the structure and why?
Good question. So, to give you an insight into my writing process, I always need a model chapter, a chapter, one chapter, and not. It's never the first chapter or the last chapter. It's somewhere in the middle that captures the tone, the voice, the essence of what I'm trying to do with the book. And in this case, it's funny you should mention Buddha Ben. It was the Buddha Ben chapter that was the model, and that alliterative Buddha Ben. And realizing that that was one side of him, that's when I realized for each chapter I can find a different Ben. And since he contains so many multitudes, to paraphrase Walt Whitman, I thought, let me do that. And it worked. I think that I was able to make the book more than just chronological, because again, I didn't want to write a conventional biography that existed. So I found a theme, a different aspect of Ben, and it sort of fits, as I say, it fits him and his personality as well, because he was so multifaceted.
Now, these chapters are arranged chronologically.
Well, we start at the end.
Oh,
We
okay.
start with resting Ben
Right,
and
right.
at his deathbed, and then we move chronologically through the rest of his life, but with a theme to each chapter. So it's not just years 1726 to 1729.
Right.
It's honing in on one aspect.
Right. So, did you write them in that order?
No,
No.
I don't. At some point I did get into the chronological order, but I don't tend to write just straight through page one to page 300 or whatever. It's not exactly the most structured process. I'm sure all the other writers you speak with, they have a very organized, disciplined process.
Not necessarily.
No, I was being sarcastic. Yeah. So we all, you do what works. And I think Ben would approve of that. He was a pragmatist. He would say, okay, if that works for you, starting in the middle, then going forward and backwards a little bit, so be it. And that's what I do.
So when you started out, so did you write the Buddha chapter first, as you say,
Yes.
the model chapter? Okay. So the when you sat down to write this book, had you already done a wide amount of reading about Ben Franklin?
Oh yes,
Okay.
yes. I tend to do, I do research on two levels at least. There's the library research, which I did a ton of, so that you don't have to, because there's a lot of dry academic work out there. There's a lot of Franklin's papers to go through. And then I travel. I do go in the footsteps of him in Boston, Philadelphia, of course, in London, Southampton, England, France. So I take you on the road, and then I take you into my life as well. But the research is done before I sit down to write.
Okay. But I'm assuming, though, as you're writing, you come up with questions where you have to go look
You
more
have to
things
fill
up.
in holes and look
Yeah.
for things. But
Yeah.
really, at that point, I've done so much research, the challenge isn't finding more information, but getting a handle on the information I've dug up.
Do you take notes by hand while you're traveling, while you're, or
While
you're
I'm traveling, and I'm okay, so I'm the son of a doctor, and I have his handwriting. So my handwriting is perishable. It has a shelf life of 24 to 48 hours, beyond which time nobody, not even myself, can decipher it. So the way I work, and I think it works to my advantage, is I'm out traveling. Say I'm in London, and I'm going to Franklin's old house and his old haunts, and I'm taking notes in a notebook. And then that evening in my hotel, I will transfer those notes to a laptop, but also expand and ask questions. And you know, it happened just a few hours ago, so I'm sort of reflecting on what I saw, and I also get it out of my notebook and onto the screen rather.
Now, I think that's a brilliant process.
Yeah, and it's sort of built out of necessity because my handwriting's so bad. But and then it becomes just a continual process of expansion and then contraction. Henry Miller said there are two phases of the writing process. There's fertilizing and cementing. Since you're there in Iowa, you get the fertilizing part. You know, that's when you're growing things, growing, you know, and then the cementing is, you know, when you're killing your darlings and chopping and smoothing things out and condensing.
Well, that's another question, which is how do you decide what to keep in, what to chuck?
I mean, I worked at NPR for a number of years, and we, back in the day of tape, when we had actual tape, the motto was use your best tape. Meaning, you're interviewing someone for 30 minutes, you're going to narrow it down to 2 minutes. Very simply, use the best stuff. Use the material that at the time you thought, wow, that's really interesting what they said. So I start with that as sort of my North Star. Like, you know, what is the most interesting? Just the most compelling that strikes me. Like, you know, Caroline said she was struck by his role in France, for instance, or you know, it could be something like that. Now, sometimes the best material just isn't relevant, and you just can't fit it in. But you start from that. That's your starting point, and then you're trying to not use repetitive good material. You want to create a profile of the man in full. And that means you need stuff from his childhood, you need personal, you need the professional, you need the best stuff from the right areas, if that makes sense.
So there might be too much good stuff from one area, from one
Yeah.
time period,
Right.
that you have to cut some of the really best out to make room for something that might not be as interesting, but you need to cover this other time period.
Right. And so keep in mind that Franklin, for the first, you know, part of his life was not famous, right? So, for instance, you know, we don't have portraits of Buff Ben. Ben was buff. He was when he, and I could have had a Buff Ben chapter now that I think about it. When he was in, you know, a teenager and in his 20s and 30s, I mean, he lifted weights. He was a boxer briefly, and he was a tremendous swimmer, an absolutely awesome swimmer at a time when most people, not even sailors, could swim, which is crazy, I know. And Ben Franklin is the only founding father inducted in the International Swimming Hall of Fame in Fort Lauderdale,
Oh my
Florida.
gosh.
So, but no one was, you know, there are no photographs back then, of course, so no one's drawing portraits of this buff, nobody 21-year-old, you know, with no money. It's only when, you know, he became famous first for his electrical experiments and then for his politics that people started drawing, painting his portrait. And so by then he's put on some pounds, and this is the sort of chubby, stout Ben that we have in our mind's eye.
Right, with gout.
With gout, and also there's, you know, we have contemporary accounts from him when he was older, because everyone's writing letters. Oh, I met the great Dr. Franklin. But really, his, you know, the first 20 or 30 years of his life, all we have is, for the most part, is his incomplete autobiography. He never finished it, and it trails off at age 50, when he's age 57, just when things are getting really interesting. He couldn't bring himself to finish it.
Wow. Well, one thing I learned about you, Eric, is you are not a good swimmer.
I'm not. Are you?
I am. Yep.
Oh, Iowa being great water world that it is. I guess you have lakes out there, but no oceans.
No oceans, and I haven't swum in the ocean a whole lot, but I actually grew up in not far from Philadelphia,
Oh,
Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yes. And
Yeah.
he's been to Lancaster and Franklin and Marshall colleges there.
That's right. That's right.
No, if you describe, if your definition of being able to swim is not drowning, then I guess I can swim. But I've never liked the water. I do the doggy paddle. I just, yeah. And that becomes a bit of a theme in the book, is my contrast with Ben swimming and me trying to be a bit more like him. And when Ben's older, someone writes to him, says, I'm in my 50s, can I still learn to swim? And Ben writes this wonderful letter to him saying, basically, yes, you can. And you have to, and really, it's not about technique, it's about having faith in the water, in the buoyancy, that you will float, you will not drown. And it was almost a kind of spiritual sentiment that there's this force, call it what you like, that is holding us up. And
Well,
I think I address that in the Floating Ben chapter.
one thing I've learned as I've aged, because I was a very slender young woman, and I am not a slender older woman, you float a lot better when you're a little heavier.
So Ben, when he was heavier, he goes to he's 79, 80 years old. He's stopping in Southampton, is way back from success in France, and is way back home to Philadelphia, and he goes to Martin's saltwater baths, one of these like spas that were cropping up, and he floats and he falls asleep while floating in the saltwater baths. And he's struck by this, and he writes this in his journal that, water makes the best blanket. So yes, Ben was a good floater.
Yeah, there's more buoyancy. You're less dense. When you're all bone and muscle, that's pretty dense. And it's. Oh, somehow I lost you. What happened? I can't hear you. Mom, can you say something?
Well, yeah, I can say something, but
Yeah, okay, I can hear you.
I can hear you. Yeah,
But
I can hear you.
yeah, but we can't all of a sudden. I had like there was a whistling sound, and then the mic cut out, I think. Hold on, he's trying to
Okay.
fix it. I can see him.
Well, I want to say too there that Ben Franklin was probably the most well-traveled of gentlemen in that age, because he traveled all the 13 colonies, and he went into Canada to try to convince them to stay with him, but they didn't, they wouldn't do it. And I found that interesting, because traveling must not have been the most easiest thing in those days.
That is true.
That's absolutely right, Caroline. He was the best traveled of the founding fathers. He racked up some 42,000 miles, with platinum
Oh my
status.
gosh. Oh my gosh.
I know. And back then, and you're right, he traveled up and down the eastern seaboard as deputy postmaster. He traveled to Canada at age 70 on what I call the Great Canadian Fiasco, trying to get the Canadians to join the American cause, and that was a big flop. Nearly killed him, because it was early spring, late winter, it was freezing cold, and he wasn't doing so well. And he crossed the Atlantic 8 times. That's a lot of crossings. And it took anywhere from 4 weeks to 13 weeks, depending on the wind. And I argue in the book that he actually did. The travel was essential to who he was. He said that travel lengthens life. I love that. And he did some of his best thinking and experimenting while in a carriage or on a ship. He, charted the Gulf Stream on a ship. He wrote something called the Albany Plan of Union in 1754, a very early idea that the colonies could unite. This was, well before the 1776. He wrote that in a carriage. And he took one journey at age 20 when he's coming back from London on his kind of abroad, summer abroad trip, to put it, year abroad trip. And this was a trip that took 13 weeks. That was just, the winds just were not cooperate, but he had time to think. And that's on that journey, that's when he came up with his plan for a plan of conduct and a plan of moral perfection. That's when I think Franklin became Franklin. That's when he decided, he'd been kind of mucking around in London as a young man. He was going to get his act together and make something with his life. And he was able to
have that epiphany because he had so much darn time sitting on that boat in the doldrums.
You know, when we think of Atlantic crossings now, we think of these huge ocean liners with all these things to entertain one and, you know, fancy restaurants and swimming pools and so forth. The boats they were crossing on weren't like that, were they?
There was not the QE2. no, they were pretty rough. Franklin, on this trip I was just discussing, he would jump overboard and, like, go swimming, you know, when the boat's just floundering, and except when there was a shark spotted somewhere in the Atlantic, and then he decided not to go for a swim. But they would play cards and drink Madeira wine and have lots of conversations. So they made the time. They did the best they could with all the time they had.
Oh, that's really interesting. So we only have a few minutes left, Eric, but I did want to ask you, we didn't really talk about Ben and electricity, which is, of course, something that he is well known for. How did he get interested in it? And, you know, he didn't really discover electricity, even though we kind of think that he did.
He didn't discover electricity, but he got interested in it actually through seeing these shows. They were sort of these performances by electricians, as they were called back then. That's what someone who studied electricity was called. And he went to one actually when he was back home visiting Boston, and he was just blown away by this performance. They would, you know, do tricks with static electricity, and he'd sort of learn something about electricity. But Ben became fascinated, and then he retired from his printing business, attempted to retire, and started experimenting with whatever equipment he had, or a friend from London would send him some equipment, and he's experimenting in Philadelphia. And really, his one great breakthrough contribution, I would say, is the conservation of charge. Before that time, people thought there were two like completely separate kinds of electricity, vitreous and ruinous. And Ben was like, no, it's just one electricity, and it's sometimes a positive charge and sometimes a negative charge. Those are his terms, positive charge, negative charge, conductor, all these terms that we still use today when we're talking about electricity, including battery, came from Ben Franklin. So he had that conceptual breakthrough, then he created a vocabulary for electricity, and then, of course, his great invention is the lightning rod, which in his time was known as the Franklin rod, of course.
Oh, boy.
So he really did fly a kite in a lightning storm?
We think so. He didn't write about it right away, but he wrote about it was discussed later. Most historians think, yes, he did fly the kite in a storm with his son William, but didn't want anyone to know that they were going to do it, because if it was a failure, he was afraid it would lead to great embarrassment and ridicule.
That makes sense. That makes
sense.
Well, Eric, it's been a real pleasure having you on Writers' Voices with us today. And
I really enjoyed this. This was a lot of fun.
And I enjoyed learning about both you and Ben Franklin in Ben and Me.
Yes.
And Caroline, do you have some closing words for us?
Yes, I do. Thomas Jefferson asked Ben Franklin to look over the Declaration of Independence after he had written it. And Franklin put these words in, which he said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." And those are words that that I remembered, and I think everyone remembers those words.
Right. So Ben was an editor of the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson originally wrote, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." Mm-hmm. And Franklin put a pen through it and said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," which is a much more modern and, I think, powerful way of phrasing a similar idea. And those are the words we remember. So, so that's just one example of sort of secret history of Ben Franklin and the sort of hidden ways that he influenced the birth of this nation.
And you can learn a lot more of those ways if you read Ben and Me.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being with us, and see you
guys. It was a pleasure. Take care.
You too. See you all next week on Writers' Voices.